Welcome to another episode of Neurodiversity with Theo Smith, where we explore the diverse spectrums of human minds and we advocate for a more inclusive world. Today, we're joined by a very special guest, Matt Hancock. Now, Matt has served as an MP since 2010 and has had several significant positions in the UK government, including Secretary of State for Health and Social Care. Pretty relevant in terms of today's conversation, right? His political journey is marked not only by his commitment to public service, but also by personal challenges and triumphs, particularly relating to his experiences with dyslexia. So diagnosed later in life, Matt has been a vocal advocate and supporter of what we consider now as the concept of neurodiversity and neuroinclusion, emphasizing the importance of early diagnosis and support in the education system. Now, he's been up to something this week that we're going to talk about and share as well, also completing the London Marathon. So, Matt, really pleased to have you on today. If you'd just like to give everybody a hello.
Yeah, great to be with you, Theo. Great to be with you.
Fantastic. So, as we normally start with these conversations, Matt, I'm interested to know, like, what does neurodiversity mean to you? When were you diagnosed, or were you aware that perhaps your brain worked in a slightly different way and you came across the topic of dyslexia? And what were some of the challenges, the opportunities, the strengths that you started to realize once you'd got the understanding and the diagnosis?
Well, at one level, we're all neurodiverse, aren't we? Everybody's brain works slightly differently. The difference and the reason this is an issue and the reason that we need to change things is that some people's brains work differently in a way that can be a challenge. So I am dyslexic. I knew at school that I had a problem because I've got the gift of the gab. I can talk. Fortunately for me, my maths is pretty good. I was terrible at the written languages, anything that needed more than a sentence or so, and I was in trouble. Now, fortunately, in England, for me, we really, really specialise after 16, right? So I could do A-levels in maths and physics and computing, and economics, anything to get away from words, basically. And then for me, I went to that got me to Oxford, right? So I'm very lucky to have got into that great university. But there I was doing an essay subject. You know, thinking back, I have no idea why I applied to do an essay-based subject. I knew I was terrible at it, but I was really interested. So I did a degree in politics, philosophy, and economics. And at the end of the first term, you know, my tutor took me aside and said, "You can talk, and when we talk in lessons, you're fine. But when you come to write it down, it's terrible. I think you're dyslexic." And he sent me off to get a formal diagnosis, and then I got all the support that I needed, and then they invented spell check, and you know, I've been able to manage it since then. But what it meant to me was, you know, finding out that there was a name for this thing, it clicked, right? It was a light bulb moment. It explained the problems that I've been having before, and why, compared to my friends, you know, I had these real issues in English, and let alone foreign languages, which I'm absolutely terrible at.
Interesting. So what you mentioned there about the finding out university, I went to university as a mature student, and it was the same experience for me. It was at university that they were like, you've got problems writing and reading. And therefore, I got the diagnosis of dyslexia then. But it wasn't until my late 30s that I had the realization that co-occurrence in ADHD and autism was also present through the experience of my child as well. And you, when we think about it, maybe generational, right, that some of this was missed.
Definitely.
Do you think that that's the case? It seems there are still barriers to kids getting recognized and supported that may be better now, but there's still those barriers.
Well, we definitely talk about it more, right? And I think people are more open to it. And there's a more of an understanding, but it's still, we're still a long way from where we need to be. You know, there was still last month, there was an article in the Times newspaper where, you know, one of their commentators said, I don't believe in ADHD. I mean, how can you not believe in a medical condition? It's a bit like saying, I don't believe in the flu. I mean, it's, you know, it's a clinically diagnosable and to a degree treatable condition. You can't just not believe in it. And so that shows that there's still a way to go, but it's definitely better than it was. But having said that, so when I worked on this when I first got elected to Parliament. I was then in government, and I did what I could in government, although not as much as I would have liked. Both when I was at the Department for Education, I was the Minister for Apprenticeships, and that is all about making sure there's other opportunities for kids who don't find straight line schooling very easy. But then at Health, I'd set up a team to work on this, and then it got knocked out by the pandemic and all hands on deck for that. So when I left government, I thought, this is the thing that I want to do. This is unfinished business for me. And I put down a question in Parliament to ask how many children have their dyslexia identified in school. And I knew that the figure from 10 years earlier had been 1 in 5. And the figure came back 1 in 5, exactly the same. So we do talk about it more. There's more of an acceptance that neurodiversity is a thing, that there's a set of conditions. They're spectrum conditions, so not everybody's got the same. You know, the whole point of diversity is that everybody is different. I think there's much more accepting that you can, that people who have a neurodiverse condition have a skill set that is different, and so long as they get the support and the mitigations to deal with the challenges, then you can actually get a lot more out of it. So I think that's, that side of things has developed quite a lot, with some real leadership from, you know, people who famously have made a lot of noise in this area, like Richard Branson and others. But in the school system, it has not happened yet. And that's the primary thing I'm campaigning for. And then also in prisons, where they are now starting to make some real progress, you know, but in schools and in prisons, there simply hasn't been enough progress on recognition, and then the support that can only come once you've been identified.
Absolutely. And we've known the data around prisons for a long time. I think the study in Chelmsford Prison that was done a very long time ago was recognising that a high proportion of prisoners, around 50%, I think, that that report and study came out with, are dyslexic. And we know too many have low numeracy skills and written, and I think it's 8, don't have the skills of an 8-year-old in terms of being able to read and write. So there is a definite disproportionate negative effect within prisons and within those who come from low socioeconomic backgrounds, right? And I do think that the opportunity here, and perhaps this will go into some of what's been going on this week and what you've been doing running the London Marathon, is it's a lower barrier to entry to gain support. So I know that the ability to get somebody a dyslexic diagnosis is much easier, for example, than to get an autism or ADHD diagnosis. But because of the co-occurrence and because of the volume of individuals who are dyslexic versus ADHD and autistic, it is a much easier mechanism to start to get people support, like you and I, or the many other people who go missed through this process. So what is it that you're focusing on now? What were you doing this week to make those changes that I know you were trying to make pre-pandemic, but unfortunately we've all had to shift our focus slightly during the last 4 or 5 years? And what does that look like, and how do you think it's going to positively impact young people now coming through?
Yeah, well, it's been a big week, because on Sunday I did the London Marathon, and I was raising funds and raising awareness for the charity that I'm setting up, the Accessible Learning Foundation, which is all about campaigning for early identification in schools and in prisons, and then the support that follows from identification. We were talking about prisons a moment ago, and you mentioned dyslexia and the stats on that. I think are very powerful. But you didn't mention ADHD, which is also prevalent amongst the prison population, and is also a manageable condition so long as it is identified. And these things are, so it's really important. And actually, the Ministry of Justice has just put a neurodiversity lead into every single prison in the country. And they're quite new, but they've recruited them. But, they are starting to make some progress in this. So that was on Sunday, running in support of the Accessible Learning Foundation. And then on Tuesday, I introduced a bill into Parliament to require the universal screening for neurodivergent conditions and teacher training in primary schools. You know, one of the unbelievable and really sad statistics that I've recently discovered is that of those who are excluded from school at primary school, 97% have a neurodivergent condition. And we know that if you get the early identification, whether it's of dyslexia or of ADHD, autism, or as you say, there's a lot of overlap between them, then we know that you can get the support into each child according to what they need, not just teaching each child as if we're all automatons and all the same, but teaching each child according to what they need. And often, in many cases, especially with dyslexia, you can teach the children to enough to be able to then get on in all the other subjects as well. And often they then start to catch up once they've had the identification. So, and the technology is now widely available to be able to do this, not the formal diagnosis, which obviously requires a person. It's and because that has an impact on budgets and all sorts. But the screening to get the data on each individual child, and I think every child in primary school should go through that.
So there's something really fascinating there, and it's the I just want to touch upon a point first of all around the treatable condition, just because my personal view and perspective, part of the reason why I started to advocate for this, is to almost like to focus on the strengths, the abilities. It's our natural way of human evolution that we have these brains. Unfortunately, we have these barriers, right? We have the systems we've built. Last 200 years of, development of the world that we live in, the infrastructure, the lights, the from factories to Facebook and beyond, right? All of these things have an impact on our neurological makeup. And therefore, those barriers that we've created, they're the barriers to our unique and incredible brains, not necessarily our brains themselves, although there's other complexity to our life's journey. So where we grew up, what we were privileged to be fed or not, and all the other stuff that also impacts on mental health, well-being, how much energy you have, whether you have too much energy. So all of those things play a key part. I just want to kind of reference that point because I think it's really important that we don't still kind of pathologize and talk about ADHD and autism, dyslexia, and as something that needs to be fixed. Society needs to be fixed in terms of its viewpoint, as referenced the article that you mentioned earlier, you see. So I think that's just really important.
Yeah, but there's something, it's even more than that, isn't it? Which is that's the way the world has gone, since it industrialized. But actually now, all the straight line stuff, that's increasingly going to be done by machines, right? It's actually the empathy, the creativity, the thinking differently. That's the bit the humans are going to add, right? Computers can do the boring stuff, and that's where people who think differently, people with a neurodiverse condition, that's where we tend to be more, have more skills. So actually it's even more of an imperative than just that there are these factors that have led to the world being structured in such a straight line way. But I think one of the last bits to catch up is the education system, which is, you know, we're no longer producing people to go and work in factories. Thanks very much. We need to produce people who are creative and understanding and can think through problems and make connections.
Yeah, absolutely. There's these different ways of seeing the world, right? You could be synesthetic or have aphantasia. You may not be able to visualize things in your mind eye. If you have aphantasia, you can't see an image in your brain, but that can give you unique skills and abilities. You may have synesthesia, like my old friend, High Contrast, Lincoln Barrett, who sees colors when he hears sounds, and that's how he creates incredible music. Or you may be like a Maggie Adairn-Pocock, who's, you know, almost got like the 3D imaging in her brain through the dyslexia. So these incredible minds. But you're right, they may have had other trauma, stigma, challenges, often in school when they were children, that have created challenges around mental health, well-being, and the ability to perform in the environment, and therefore may need medical intervention, which I think is important. The thing you mentioned around early diagnosis, I utilized 5 years ago for my child, because the school weren't seeing what we were seeing because they weren't at home with us. And because she's a girl, I utilized Professor Amanda's Do It profiler for my child and for myself. And I used that to evidence our experience, what we were seeing, feeling, in a language that the school understood. And that's really important, Matt. And I think this is why we need to move beyond the stats and the data that you were talking about, especially within the education setting, because the education setting is not shifting quick enough for this. And I think getting in there and getting that kind of early, let's not call it diagnosis, let's call it early understanding.
Yeah.
Right. And that early understanding, the parents and the teachers need to be speaking the same language.
Yeah.
And so do the medical world. Right. And unfortunately, they're not, the three of them, almost speaking languages that are not connected.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of confusion for teachers who are under a lot of pressure to be able to support their child. When I went in with that information,
yeah,
I had a better way of communicating it.
Yeah.
And the teachers were able then to understand it. What did that get us? It got us some support.
Yeah.
And there are so many people who don't have that understanding, don't have the ability to use a profiler in this way. So I think this bill, this journey to get that support as early as possible for all children in the education system is transformative. And you can probably put a number on it, Matt, of the potential positive impact if we think on the health and social.
Oh, yeah. I can stick my finger in the air, the best of them. The figures are always slightly back of a fag packet, but because it's not just about the economic value, which is what those sorts of figures measure, it's about the impact on so many people's lives. I've got a lot of time for the Do It profile. I think it's really, really, it's really, really smart, because it tells you, it is about shared understanding, you know. And there's a big false debate about labels as well, right? Should we have labels or not? Well, actually, understanding about the individual and how that individual's brain works is incredibly valuable. In my case, putting a name to that was really helpful, because it helped me to understand myself. But what really matters is knowing how your brain works, and if it does work differently to most people, therefore getting the support that you need to be able to take that into account. That's what we're talking about. And I think that some of the debates around this miss the point, that it isn't there isn't a yes no here. It's about how do you make sure we know as much as we need to know about each individual child, and then get them the support that they need so that they can reach their potential. And that's what this bill is aimed at. That's why I'm calling for universal screening and identification. I'm not using the language of diagnosis, and you could call it universal understanding, if you like. I think that's a good way of talking about it as well. It is about teachers, parents, and children themselves, age appropriate, understanding how their brains work and what they need to do to make the most of it.
Absolutely. My daughter doesn't talk about labels, right? Because that's not the way that we deliver it. Although she has the labels because that's got her the additional support that she required that wasn't available to her. But she talks more.
But you know, not every parent's like you, unfortunately. No. Not every parent can do this. This is why we need, you know, if you believe in a universal education system, then we need universal screening to understand how people's brains work. Because sadly, it gets me really angry. There's a real social injustice, which is that at the top end of the socioeconomic spectrum, if you like, you get more diagnosis than elsewhere in the system. And that's because there are parents who can go out of their way. And I don't blame them at all. I support them to go out of their way and support their child. Of course, it's the number one duty of a parent to support their children. But not everybody can do that. And that's where the state comes in.
Absolutely. And there's something that you mentioned earlier on around the decision that you made of which degree to go and do. And it was probably a poor one to go and do that based on the way that your brain worked. However, I find that's a common problem. And probably if we think about the longer term impact and effect of the jobs people select, when you're younger, because you don't realize how your brain is working and because you get fed a lot of information that's inaccurate for your brain, you then go on to make poor decisions around career choices, sometimes around partnerships, friends, because you don't understand what is going on in the brain. And as I was mentioning about my daughter there, she has a much better understanding that she's overstimulated in certain environments, that she can have burnout. Once she knows this, forget about the label or the tag, that understanding means you can make better choices.
Yeah.
Yes, I will go to this party, but afterwards I'm going to be really tired. Yes, I can go to this event, or yes, I can go meet these people, but there is an effect that it has on me, that now I'm aware of it, I won't get burnt out, or I won't make inappropriate choices that can affect my state of mental health and well-being. So from that perspective, when we talk about treatable, I think that is the most powerful concept, which is, yes, it's treatable. If we have an understanding of ourselves, then we can decide, if we have a headache, do we go for a walk, or do we take paracetamol, or do we drink more water?
Yeah.
Right, we have a choice.
Yeah.
We don't just have to take paracetamol. We don't just have to never go into a particular environment again. I think that choice is powerful. So I guess just off that, the point that you made initially, how do you see that?
I agree. I think it's really important that we don't over-medicalize the problem, but also recognize that there is a clinical medical element to it. It is so empowering to understand how your brain works. That's the thing. It's empowering. It's so important. And it's also these days much, much easier. You know, the technology for understanding how our brains work is so much smarter than it was even 5 years ago, let alone 10. So one of the reasons that I really, really want to see change here is that I see so much opportunity for individuals and for using technology to help people to understand themselves so that they can, as you put it, make better decisions and get the external support that they need as well. You know, it's technology is our friend here, and we should embrace it. So there's a real opportunity for change, and I'm glad that, you know, the bill got cross-party support, people from all different parties in the House of Commons. So this isn't a political thing; it's about a change in society that we need to see, and in particular in the education system.
Yeah, and that's why I was so interested to have you on, Matt, because for me, this is really important that we tackle the problem. I've wanted to tackle it myself, I've had to focus on business because that is so to get business ready for when my child gets there, and when other families are sending off their kids to work or to university or whatever else it may be. But getting in at those very early stages, I think, will be transformational. But why is it taken so long, Matt? Why, you know, if we think around the level of knowledge, specifically around dyslexia, and even neurodiversity as a concept, you know, has really been taken off for the last 4 or 5 years. Why do you think we're still not at a position where schools have better understanding and education themselves about this topic? And how quickly do you think we'll be able to get to the stage where we really get a good level of understanding within the school system?
I don't know why it's taken so long. I mean, there has been a massive drive for improved literacy in England over the last couple of decades, really, with the Academies programme that started under the last Labour government and then onwards. And that has improved literacy quite strongly. But you can't get to 100% literacy unless you tackle dyslexia. And I think that it just hasn't had the attention that it needs, and it needs the focus. And it needs people to stop, to get past this debate about labels that we just talked about, and get on to supporting each individual child, and not think that somehow it's not rigorous to do that. So that's I think there's been, you know, a campaign against by a group of people who've been so passionate about standards and about rigor that they've left this. A more crucial issue to the side, and now are starting to make progress on it. You know, the green, in government terms, the green paper that they published last year was a big step forward. Introduced mandatory training on neurodiversity into teacher training for the first time. I want to see that much broader, but at least it's there, so there's some progress. And they've talked about early identification, which is important as well. So there is some progress, and I want to see that go much faster.
And what do you think are the future policies and reforms that we'll see coming in that are going to support this? Because I guess you know, we've just heard Dyspraxia Foundation, I think, has closed its doors. There is challenges, you know, locally, globally, but locally across the UK, I think there are challenges for parents getting support. So this almost feels like the first step, right? Because we help with understanding, we help teachers better understand, and parents be able to get that diagnosis, or again, the recognition that there may be challenges there for their child. So where would we go from here to ensure that it's sustainable, it's ongoing, and we can really make a positive difference for the foreseeable future?
Well, I've seen the pressure that families have been under when they haven't been able to get the financial support they need. The government put a big injection of extra cash into the system a month or so ago, just over a month ago, for the next academic year. And I hope that makes a difference. So there is the funding side. Of course there is. And we need to keep the pressure up there. But it's about so much more than just the money. It's about how money is used, about what people do in the classroom. The specific thing I'd like to see is that along with the phonics test at the end of year one, I'd like to see effectively a neurodiversity test. I mean, I started out campaigning for a dyslexia assessment, which you would get by, alongside the phonics test, having a test for oral language capabilities, because dyslexia is essentially a gap between your oral language capability and your ability to get that down on paper. And if a child has poor phonics but high language skills, they're highly likely to be dyslexic, and they need different support to the child that has poor language and poor written language skills. You know, they are two different problems, but the phonics test would show up with exactly the same result for those two kids. So it's, the phonics test is sort of half of what we need. So that's in the dyslexia space. But there are now these screeners coming on screen, like the Do It one that you mentioned, and others, other screeners are available. that can also identify a likelihood or a tendency towards ADHD and autism, and they are incredibly valuable as well. So I'd like to see all of that happen for every primary school student, because then we can spend the money that's needed for diagnosis and the support that follows that best targeted on people who are on the children who are most likely to have these problems, as opposed to your likelihood of getting that diagnosis being in part determined by whether your parents have got the wherewithal, care enough about it, and of course the ability to pay.
And how do we ensure then that we meet the kind of the diversity within neurodiversity? Because of course we know, you know, women, just as one example, are underrepresented in terms of diagnosis and support because of the model, the way that it's been set up. And then that's before we even get to ethnicity, cultural diversities, communities. You know, how do we make sure that the bill goes far enough that we cover everybody in society, right? And it does, that doesn't just become those privileged few based on gender and...
Well, it's, yeah. The idea is the exactly the opposite of that, as in it's to address that problem. Because if you can assess every child as an individual, then you'll see their strengths and weaknesses. And of course, you know, if English is your second language, for instance, then you've got to take that into account. In terms of women being identified, particularly for autism and ADHD, less so. This applies less for dyslexia, where there is less of a gender divide. But, you know, girls present very differently to boys with ADHD and autism, especially pre-puberty, much, much less likely to have a very obvious behavioural indications. And so that is really important. But some of the, for instance, within ADHD, some of the eye movement tests are able to identify a tendency, not an absolute, but a tendency that is more equal across the two genders. So that is a critical question. But I think that this drive helps to solve those problems, as it makes it better rather than making it worse. Because I think the current system is just really, you know, is not addressing that at all.
No. Okay. So, and just tell us a little bit about what you intend to do after your career in politics. A bit of a conversation around the Accessible Learning Foundation, and other than the bill, what's next?
Yeah. Well, when I decided to stand down from Parliament, I wanted to see how I could keep driving this agenda forward. You know, it's the only thing I'm campaigning on, other than, of course, supporting my constituency between now and the next election, when I'm going to be standing down from Parliament. But this is the thing I want to keep campaigning on. And so I decided to set up the Accessible Learning Foundation. It's now got a brilliant director and board of trustees who are driving it forward and doing a great job. And it is both about continuing the campaign on the policy, which is what we've been talking about, but also then directly delivering in schools. You know, some schools don't have the budget. Other schools don't have the, you know, they know they want to do this or that they should, but they don't know how to go about it. And so it's about getting into schools and making sure there's provision for early identification. And then it's also about working with prisons, where there's progress. I'd say there's more progress being made at a policy level in prisons, but delivering that on the ground is and knowing what good looks like is much harder. So we'll be working with prisons, and we've got some excellent trustees who have a deep experience of the criminal justice system, and working to push push the agenda, keep pushing the agenda in education. So yeah, that's one of the things I'll be doing after I leave, and just doing it slightly differently.
Great. So what does the next 12 to 24 months look like then? What would you hope for? What would be success in 24 months' time if you could look back? What should we see?
Well, number one, I hope my bill becomes law. If I can't get it through between now and the election, because there isn't that much time left and these things take time in Parliament, then I hope that somebody picks it up after the election and keeps driving it forward. That's number one. Number two, I want to see the universal screening and early identification of neurodivergent conditions made policy by the Department for Education so that all schools need to do it. Number three, I'd like to see that actually implemented on the ground within 24 months, certainly. These things take time, but there really isn't an excuse anymore. The technology is available and schools have shown how they can do it within existing budgets. And four, I hope the Accessible Learning Foundation which is, I only founded it 6 months ago, so it's still quite a new organization, that it really gets going and it's delivering in schools and in prison settings to get that identification and support. And I hope that at a national level, the debate has moved on from a debate about whether this is necessary to a debate about how we best help each individual child. And ultimately, this will take longer than 24 months. I hope that no child leaves primary school without understanding how their brain works.
Yeah, and certainly making it easier for the parents so that they don't have to fight tooth and nail for something that they shouldn't be fighting that hard for.
Exactly.
And the amount of stories and communities that I hear, it's with everything else that's going on in the world, it's an added level of pressure and stress that I absolutely know parents don't deserve and don't need. So if people want to get involved, Matt, if people want to support, if people are listeners, what can they do? What would you advise them to do?
Well, the first thing is my Just Giving page for my marathon effort is still open. So if you go to Just Giving and search for Matt Hancock ALF, Accessible Learning Foundation ALF, please donate. The second thing is that on the Accessible Learning Foundation website, you can sign up to our newsletter and you can get involved through doing that. And the third thing is if you write to your local MP and ask them to support my bill, which I introduced into Parliament on Tuesday, and to make sure that they support this agenda and give it all the backing that it needs.
Brilliant. Well, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. I think the timing's right. I think there's enough energy behind this. We should get some success and see this starting to help people as early as possible.
Because I think let's hope so. So Theo, are you going to do those three things?
Yeah,
you're on the Just Giving site. Yeah,
That's not a problem.
Sign up for the Alpha newsletter.
Those three things.
And you've written to your local. Who's your local MP?
They're fairly low barriers to entry. I'm part of my. Neuro difference is that I'm terrible with names, so I couldn't tell you, I get confused between a couple of them. But it's Cheshire East.
Don't worry.
So you might know Cheshire East.
Cheshire East. Whereabouts in Cheshire East?
Holmes Chapel.
Holmes Chapel. All right, that's Fiona Bruce.
Yeah,
MP for Congress.
Here we go. Thank you. So I'll write.
Very nice lady. Fiona, Yeah, you can email her at fiona.bruce.mp@parliament.uk.
There we go. Wonderful. Consider that done. Those three things done. And I advocate for anybody else to do the same, to be able to get this bill over the line. Right. Brilliant. Thanks so much, Matt. Anything else you'd like to share with our audience before you go?
No, that's been great talking to you, Theo. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, real pleasure.